Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, April 7, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, plentiful sunshine, highs to 83 degrees Fahrenheit, winds north at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, clear skies, lows to 52 degrees Fahrenheit. Winds south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts a mainly sunny sky, highs near 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Winds east-northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, Trump Advises Country Lining Up to Talk Tariffs. This article was written by Adriana Gomez-Licon of the Associated Press, Dateline Fort Lauderdale. Top administration officials said Sunday that more than 50 countries targeted by President Donald Trump's new tariffs have reached out to begin negotiations over the sweeping import taxes that have sent financial markets reeling, raised fears of a recession, and upended the global trading system. The higher rates are set to be collected beginning Wednesday, ushering in a new era of economic uncertainty with no clear end in sight. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said unfair trade practices are not the kind of thing you can negotiate away in days or weeks. The United States, he said, must see what the countries offer and whether it's believable. Trump, who spent the weekend in Florida playing golf, posted online that we will win, hang tough, it won't be easy. His cabinet members and economic advisors were out in force Sunday defending the traffics and the tariffs and downplaying the consequences for the global economy. There doesn't have to be a recession. Who knows how the market is going to react in a day or in a week, Bessent said. What we are looking at is building a long-term economic fundamentals for prosperity. U.S. stock futures dropped on Sunday evening as the tariffs continue to roil the markets. Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P 500 futures fell nearly 4%, while NASDAQ futures went down nearly 5%. Even the price of Bitcoin, which held relatively stable last week, fell nearly 6% on Sunday. Trump's tariff blitz announced April 2nd fulfilled a key campaign promise as he acted without Congress to redraw the rules of global trade. It was a move decades in the making for Trump, who has long denounced foreign trade deals as unfair to the U.S. He is gambling that voters will be willing to endure higher prices for everyday items to enact his economic vision. Countries are scrambling to figure out how to respond to the tariffs, with China and others retaliating quickly. Top White House economic advisor Kevin Hassett acknowledged that other countries are angry and retaliating and, he said, by the way, coming to the table. He cited the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative as reporting that more than 50 nations had reached out to the White House to begin talks. Adding to the turmoil, the new tariffs are hitting American allies and adversaries alike, including Israel, which is facing a 17% tariff. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to visit the White House Monday, with his office saying the tariffs would be a point of discussion with Trump along with the war in Gaza and other issues. Another American ally, Vietnam, a major manufacturing center for clothing, has been in touch with the administration about the tariffs. Trump said Vietnam's leader said in a telephone call that his country wants to cut their tariffs down to zero if they are able to make an agreement with the U.S. And a key European partner, Italian Premier Giorgia Meloni, said she disagreed with Trump's move but was ready to deploy all the tools, negotiating and economic necessary to support our businesses and our sectors that may be penalized. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick made clear there was no postponing tariffs that are days away. The tariffs are coming, of course they are, he said, adding that Trump needed to reset global trade, but he committed only to having them definitely remain for days and weeks. In Congress, where Trump's Republican Party has long championed free trade, the tariffs regimen has been met with applause but also significant unease. Several Republican senators have already signed onto a new bipartisan bill that would require presidents to justify new tariffs to Congress. Lawmakers would then have to approve the tariffs within 60 days or they would expire. Nebraska GOP Representative Don Bacon said Sunday that he would introduce a House version of the bill, saying that Congress needs to restore its powers over tariffs. The next front page article is titled, Arizona House to Vote to Strip Funds Over DEI. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. The Arizona House is set to vote as early as this week on whether to eliminate state funds for universities and colleges that offer courses on diversity, equity, and inclusion. It comes as lawmakers in the chamber seem unable to agree on exactly what is DEI and what could lead to the potential for a school to potentially lose hundreds of millions of dollars because of a single course that is considered offensive. And it comes against a national backdrop of Republican President Donald Trump issuing edicts about what materials and even what phrases will put institutions at risk of losing their federal funding. Most recently, that led to the U.S. Naval Academy to remove nearly 400 books from its collection, with officials there saying they want to ensure compliance with all directives outlined in executive orders issued by the president. Even just the threat of lost dollars has some institutions scrambling, with the University of Arizona eliminating the phrase committed to diversity and inclusion from its statement acknowledging that it sits on the lands of indigenous people. Arizona law already bars the use of gender and racial preferences in hiring and promotion in public agencies. This proposal by Senator David Farnsworth to tie state funding to eliminating DEI courses goes farther. The Mesa Republican, who was taking education courses at a community college, said he was surprised at what he found in some required reading. He said that included references to hidden curricula and that often reinforces the values of the dominant culture, meaning white, middle-class, heterosexual, English-speaking, and Christian norms. Senate Bill 1694 would deny state funds to any institution that offers one or more courses that fit into that category of DEI. It contains an extensive set of definitions of what that would include. For example, off-limits would be courses that relate to contemporary American society, to issues such as systemic racism, implicit bias, race or gender-based diversity, or race or gender-based inclusion. Also forbidden would be anything that promotes the idea that racially neutral or colorblind laws perpetuate injustice and race-based privilege, including white supremacy or privilege. During House debate this week, lawmakers focused on different sections. Representative Alexander Kolodin, a Scottsdale Republican, cited language that bars state funding of colleges whose courses promote the differential treatment of any individual or group of individuals based on race or ethnicity in contemporary American society. He said the bill also would include any course that promotes the idea that a student is biased on account of that student's race or sex. He called all that just common sense. Kolodin also noted it does not prohibit discussion of historical movements, ideologies, or instances of racial hatred or race-based discrimination, such as slavery, removal of Indians from their land, and the internment of Japanese Americans. But that's not absolute. The measure does say those could not be taught if they violate the broader guidelines, like the ones talking about systemic racism, implicit bias, and race-based privilege. Representative Nancy Gutierrez said that still places limits on what can be taught and learned in courses like the ones she said this legislation effectively would ban. Consider, said the Tucson Democrat, the nature of running for the legislature itself. Learning about others' backgrounds makes us more respectful and well-rounded as a body, she said. Ditto, said Gutierrez, about being on a corporate board or in a classroom. It benefits all of us as a state and community to incorporate open-mindedness and understanding into academic programs where young people will be interacting with each other, she said. Representative Cesar Aguilar, Democrat of Phoenix, said, the legislation amounts to erasing the very history that makes this country what it is today. All that comes back to a point. Representative Walt Blackman said he's trying to make about the lack of consensus, even among the people making the laws, as to what is DEI and what the state should and should not restrict. Blackmun, the first African-American Republican elected to the state house, may have found some common ground with Democrats who see the measure as an improper state intrusion into academic affairs. He said anything that gives preference based on race, gender, or other basis is a bad idea, if for no other reason than it promotes the belief that someone got a job because of those factors. But he said what is taught about the state and nation's history of racism and sexism should be left to school officials. I don't want someone hiring me just because I happen to be an African American, Blackmun said. I don't want someone in the background thinking the only reason why you got this job is because of the color of your skin. I want to be hired on my own merits. But then there's the historical record. I was born in a time in 1965 when this was real and it was needed, and my family was discriminated against, he told colleagues. And I couldn't go to some hospitals when I was six, and my parents were driving all night long to find a hospital because they would not take black children or black people. Now, he said, the question is whether some of those programs have outlived their usefulness and, in fact, are actually a drawback. Are we sending the wrong message to young people of color that your ethnic background is what gets you in the door? Blackmun said, or is it your heart, your desire to do that job? But while the legislation focuses on what can and cannot be taught, with the threat of financial penalties on offending colleagues and universities, there's also the question of whether racism still exists or is simply some historical artifact. Representative Quanta Cruz said she can answer at least part of that from her own experiences. On one hand, the Phoenix Democrat told other lawmakers she has never been given a job because she's black. But then there's the other side of that. You see, Quanta, when she applies for a job, never gets an interview, Cruz said, but Marie does. That's her middle name, and Cruz said that's why her resume includes only her middle name. She said that was true when she got hired as an appraiser with the Maricopa County Assessor's Office. Like Kalodin, Cruz also went to the language of SB 1694 to make her case, but she reached different conclusion of what it would mean. Consider, she said, prohibitions against relating contemporary American society to social justice. This country has a very rich history which includes good, bad, and very disturbing, including me not getting jobs because my name is Quanta, she said. It is racism not to hire somebody, not even to give an interview to someone overqualified because of their name. Other lawmakers focused on their own interpretations of what the measure would do. One of the worries that I have about the way we are talking about race is that it either seems so big that somehow white people now have to feel guilty for everything that happened in the past, or that black people have to be disempowered by race, said Representative Matt Gress, Republican of Phoenix, who supports the legislation. This is a conversation that has gone in the wrong direction. On that, Blackmun agrees, which is why he's raising questions about whether to advance this measure in its current form. We need to have some hard conversations about this, he told Capital Media Services in an interview Saturday. He said that means separating out the issue of equal and race-blind opportunity, which he supports, and restricting academic conversation on everything that came before, such as how blacks like he and his family were treated. Universities should be a place where kids can go and grow and learn what they want to do, he said. Calling dictating to teachers what the state wants them to teach counterintuitive to what we look at as freedom and liberty. Blackmun said this isn't an endorsement of what's being taught by all teachers in all classes, saying that he, like Farnsworth, has found some lessons to be inappropriate. However, I'm a constitutionalist as well, he said. We cannot say that we believe in the Constitution and that we believe in freedom of speech and we believe in liberty and freedoms. However, we are limiting that as a government. That is what we left England for. But Representative Lisa Fink said she finds no problem with eliminating what she called divisive curriculum. What we're seeing is a decline in academic performance in the universities, the Glendale Republican said during the House debate. What DEI does is take the focus off of academics. Fink said in a separate interview she bases that on her belief that students who are graduating lack background in history and civics, something that makes them less prepared to teach. and Beyond Education graduates, she said some business officials have told her that graduates are not prepared for the jobs they need to fill. But Representative Betty Villegas questioned why anyone would want to block the teaching of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Things she said include opportunity, respect, inclusivity, fairness, and collaboration. As a woman that has gone through many generations, I don't understand why people are so afraid of that term and so afraid about each other's cultures, said the Tucson Democrat. Of note is that the only testimony against the measure came from the American Civil Liberties Union and the Arizona Students Association, with no objections from the Arizona Board of Regents. Instead, Regents spokeswoman Megan Gilbertson would say only that board members are working closely with lawmakers and the governor's office on bills relating to our universities. But it may also be that the Regents are counting on a veto from Governor Katie Hobbs if and when the bill gets to her. The Democratic governor has a record of rejecting ideas that come to her with no support from members of her own party. Another issue is that the legislation lacks an apparent enforcement mechanism, with no detail on how a complaint can be made against a course and who adjudicates whether it runs afoul of the law. Farnsworth acknowledges there may be an issue and said, if it becomes the law, he likely would have to come back next year with some new provisions. Our next front page article is titled Mass Layoffs Compound Problems at Head Start. This article was written by Mariah Belengit, an AP education writer. Dateline Washington. The problems for Head Start began days after President Donald Trump took office. Trump's administration announced it would freeze federal grants, the primary funding for the early education program that serves more than 500,000 low-income children. Then came glitches with the funding website that forced nearly 24 Head Start centers to close temporarily. Even after the funding freeze was aborted and the website was restored, those who run the programs remained on edge. On Tuesday, the administration gave them another reason to worry: mass layoffs. Scores of government employees who help administer Head Start, which is federally funded but run by schools and nonprofits, were put on leave. Preschool operators say they have received no communications from the Office of Head Start and don't know who to turn to if they have questions about grants or need the office to sign off on equipment expenditures. They fear the program, which serves some of the nation's neediest kids and families, could fall victim to the Trump administration's sweeping cuts. Head Start was started 6 decades ago as part of President Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty. While the early childhood program has enjoyed bipartisan support since then, some Republicans have emphasized its shortcomings and criticized efforts to increase funding. And Project 2025, the policy blueprint created by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, called for eliminating Head Start altogether. Joel Ryan, head of the Washington State Association of Head Start, said he's worried the administration is slowly dismantling the program without outright eliminating it. It doesn't have to be from an act of Congress, Ryan said. You can kneecap programs simply by cutting significant numbers of their workforce. Head Start operates in all 50 states, helping families who are homeless or are in poverty. Parents who otherwise would not be able to afford childcare rely on it when they work or go to school. Supporters say that underscores the importance of Head Start to the economy and at-risk children alike. At least 5 of the 12 regional offices for Head Start were closed Tuesday as part of layoffs at the Department of Health and Human Services, according to the National Head Start Association. While individuals' preschool funding remains unchanged, the association's statement said the cuts happened without a clear plan for how the administration intends to supporting Head Start. Some worry Head Start will become partisan. What I don't want Head Start to be is a political football, said Rhett Cecil, executive director of the Indiana Head Start Association, because a Republican household, a Democratic household, a Libertarian household could be a Head Start household. In mid-March, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., whose department oversees Head Start, visited the Head Start in Alexandria, Virginia, praising the program and its staff. It had a very inspiring tour. Kennedy said in a video on his department's Instagram account. They're getting the kind of education and socialization that they need. Still, advocates worry that GOP's efforts to slash the federal budget will ensnare programs like Head Start. Already, the staff layoffs have caused concern. Head Start preschools in Washington State have been awaiting approval to replace down fencing around a playground and to buy a refrigerator for a center. Ryan said he fears some operators will lose funding because grant applications won't get processed. The preschools are deeply reliant on federal money. During the brief hold on federal grants, no program was impacted more immediately. Unable to make payroll for the day of the freeze, several Head Start centers temporarily closed, cutting off child care for low-income families for whom a day without work is often a day without pay. The news about the funding freeze emerged in January as Head Start leaders from across the country were together at the Capitol Hilton, a few blocks away from the White House, preparing to meet with Congress members. Gathered in a conference room, many leaders simultaneously realized they were locked out of their funds. You could almost feel the wave of panic all over the room, and I think we all realized at the same time that everyone was locked out of that payment management system, said Chandra Hillman, executive director of Early Flowers Learning. The group operates 17 Head Start campuses in rural parts of northwestern Michigan. A few hours later, Hillman had to make the call. She would shut down the Early Flowers Learning campuses. Kaylee Lawrence, whose daughter attends Early Flowers, traveled with Hillman to D.C. as part of a parent advisory council. She had been reeling at the possibility that her daughter would have no place to go the following day, or that her beloved preschool would close. So when Lawrence heard Hillman make the announcement, she fell apart. The title of our next front page article is Judge Maryland's Man's Deportation Wholly Lawless. This article was written by the Associated Press, Dateline Greenbelt, Montana. Maryland, rather. The U.S. government decision to arrest a Maryland man and send him to a notorious prison in El Salvador appears to be wholly lawless. A federal judge wrote Sunday in a legal opinion explaining why she had ordered the Trump administration to bring him back to the United States. There is little to no evidence to support a vague, uncorroborated allegation that Kilmar Abrego Garcia was once in the MS-13 street gang, U.S. District Judge Paula Zenix wrote. And in any case, she said the immigration judge had expressly barred the U.S. in 2019 from deporting Abrego Garcia to El Salvador, where he faced likely persecution by local gangs. As defendants acknowledged, they had no legal authority to arrest him, no justification to detain him, and no grounds to send him to El Salvador, let alone deliver him into one of the most dangerous prisons in the Western Hemisphere, Xenix wrote. She said it was eye-popping that the government had argued that it could not be forced to bring Abrego Garcia back because he is no longer in U.S. custody. They do indeed cling to the stunning proposition that they can forcibly remove any person, migrant and U.S. citizen alike, to prisons outside the United States, and then boldly assert that they have no way to effectuate return because they are no longer the custodian, and the court thus lacks jurisdiction, Zenix wrote. As a practical matter, the facts say otherwise. The Justice Department has asked the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to pause the next ruling. Abrego Garcia, a 29-year-old Salvadorian national who has never been charged or convicted of any crime, was detained by immigration agents and deported last month. Abrego Garcia had a permit from DHS to legally work in the U.S. and was a sheet metal apprentice pursuing a journeyman's license, his attorney said. His wife is a U.S. citizen. The White House described Abrego Garcia's deportation as an administrative error, but has also cast him an MS-13 gang member. Attorneys for Abrego Garcia said there's no evidence he was in MS-13. In her order Sunday, Zenix referenced earlier comments from now-suspended Justice Department attorney Erez Ravini, in which Ravini said We concede he should not have been removed to El Salvador, and that he responded, "I don't know," when asked why Abrego Garcia was being held. The Justice Department placed Ruivani on leave after he made the comments. Attorney General Pam Bondi, in an interview on Fox News Sunday, likened Ruivani's comments to a defense attorney walking in conceding something in a criminal matter. "That would never happen in this country," she said, "so he's on administrative leave now, and we'll see what happens." Stacey Young, a former Justice Department lawyer and founder of Justice Connection, a network of department alumni that works to support employees, released a statement that defended Ruivani and said he has zealously represented the United States in some of the most high-stakes and controversial immigration cases under the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations. "Justice Department attorneys are being put in an impossible position. Obey the president or uphold their ethical duty to the court and the Constitution," Young said. "We should all be grateful to DOJ lawyers who choose principle over politics and the rule of law over partisan loyalty." Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at any time on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. First article is titled, "Spike in Migrants Held in ICE Detention." This article was written by Daniel Gonzalez of the Arizona Republic. The number of immigrants being held in detention facilities in ICE custody has increased significantly since President Donald Trump took office in January, according to the latest government data. The average daily number of immigrants being held in ICE detention facilities rose above 47,000 in March. That is the highest level of ICE detainees since November 2019, during Trump's first term, according to government data obtained by the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse. The data also indicates that under the Trump administration's expanding immigration crackdown, ICE is arresting more immigrants from the interior of the United States, including those with only pending criminal charges, and placing them in detention facilities slated for deportation. Arizona had the fifth highest number of ICE detainees of any state as of March, a TRAC data showed, although not all states have facilities for holding immigration detainees. What's more, immigrants arrested in other states are often transferred to detention facilities in Arizona, which is closer to the border with Mexico, before they are deported. The average daily population of ICE detainees nationwide increased by nearly 8,600 from October, the first month of the current fiscal year, to March 38,714 to 47,304,000, ICE data shows. That was a 22% jump. Most of that increase took place from January to March under the Trump administration, the data shows. The data also indicates the number of immigrants being arrested from the interior of the U.S. is increasing, while the number of immigrants being arrested near the border is going down. The number of immigration arrests by U.S. Customs and Border Protection decreased more than 17% from 24,430 in October to 20,148 in March, the data shows. Arrests by CBP, which includes the Border Patrol, tend to take place near the border and typically involve recent border crossers. Meanwhile, the number of immigration detainees arrested by ICE jumped from 90% from 14,284 in October to 27,156 in March, the data shows. The decrease in immigration detainees arrested by CBP reflects a decrease in the number of migrants crossing the border, said Colleen Putzel-Kavanaugh, a policy analyst at the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Border patrol encounters fell to 7,180 in March along the entire southern border. March's border patrol encounters were the lowest in decades. They represent a 94% decrease compared to the more than 133,000 encounters in March the year before, according to U.S. Customs and Border Enforcement data. Meanwhile, the increase in immigration detainees arrested by ICE indicates more immigrants are being arrested in the interior of the U.S., Putzel Kavanaugh said. Slightly more than half of the 47,000 immigrants held in detention in ICE custody in March had been convicted of crimes or had pending criminal charges, the data shows. The data also shows that under the Trump administration, more immigrants with only pending criminal charges are winding up in ICE detention. The daily average of ICE detainees with pending criminal convictions doubled to nearly 10,000 in March, up from less than 5,000 in October, the data shows. The increase in ICE detainees, including those with only pending criminal convictions or no criminal records, reflects a tougher stance on immigration under the Trump administration, Putzel Kavanaugh said. Under the Biden administration's prosecutorial discretion guidelines, ICE officials were instructed to weigh the totality of circumstances, including the severity of criminal charges and the person's ties to the U.S., before deciding whether to arrest someone, Putzel Kavanaugh said. The Trump administration, meanwhile, is directing ICE to arrest as many people as possible, regardless of their circumstances, she said. The goal, obviously, of mass deportation is the guiding factor, Putzel Kavanaugh said. The average daily population of ICE detainees housed at four facilities in Arizona in March was 2,246, according to ICE data. The Eloy Detention Center, located about 65 miles south of downtown Phoenix, had the highest daily average population in March at 1,329. The Florence Service Processing Center and the Central Arizona Florence Correctional Center, both in Florence, each had daily average populations of 379 and 378, respectively, in March, the data shows. The fourth facility, the Florence Staging Facility, had 178. Detention facilities in Arizona have remained near capacity despite the huge decrease in migrants crossing the border after the Trump administration implemented policies that essentially shut down access to asylum, said Laura St. John, legal director at the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project. The nonprofit group provides legal assistance to detained immigrants in Arizona detention facilities. The next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, State Forecasts at Risk. This article was written by Sammy Travis of Cronkite News. Deep cuts at the nation's weather agency could put Arizonans at risk by hampering forecasts for haboobs, monsoons, flash flooding, and wildfires. One in 10 employees of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have been fired or taken buyouts since President Donald Trump took office. His administration has proposed eliminating another 10% of the workforce, though so far that plan has been stymied in court. NOAA, which includes the National Weather Service, provides forecasts, severe storm warnings, and climate monitoring. Among other changes, the reductions have forced the agency to scale back its use of weather balloons needed for accurate readings and forecasts. Weather balloon launches have reportedly been scaled back or stopped at 11 of the 92 stations in North America and the Pacific Islands. Two stations in Arizona use weather balloons. No reductions in launches have been reported so far at those. It's possible that removing five or six stations in particular locations won't degrade the forecast at all. That's possible, but it's unlikely, said Matei Georgescu, a professor at Arizona State University School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning. We're conducting a real-time meteorology experiment now. This is certainly disheartening. Models that predict extreme and sudden events such as snowstorms, tornadoes, monsoons, dust storms, and wildfires require real-time data on temperature, wind, and other measures, he said. They need a starting point, he said. If you have a starting point that's wrong, then your forecast will suffer. We can't expect the model to come up with magic. As summer approaches, concerns will grow in Arizona about haboobs, massive walls of dust and sand that sweep across the landscape. Residents of the Southwest and other dry regions around the world can attest to their blinding ferocity. Dust storms can reduce visibility for drivers, increasing the risk of crashes. According to a 2023 study in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, there were 232 deaths from wind-blown dust events from 2007 to 2017 in the U.S., mostly in the Southwest. A stretch of Interstate 10 near Picacho Peak between Phoenix and Tucson is a hotspot for such crashes and fatalities. The Arizona Department of Transportation tells drivers to pull aside, stay alive during dust storms. A 2023 study in the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine that looked at vehicle crashes in Phoenix over a decade found that these warnings saved lives, warnings that rely on data from NOAA. Agency officials declined to discuss concerns that cuts will hinder forecasting. NOAA remains dedicated to its mission, providing timely information, research, and resources that serve the American public and ensure our nation's environmental and economic resilience, the agency said in a statement. We continue to provide weather information, forecasts, and warnings pursuant to our public safety mission. Cuts at NOAA are part of an effort to drastically and quickly shrink the federal workforce led by billionaire Trump advisor Elon Musk. Critics say NOAA's $6.6 billion annual budget is far too modest to yield much savings and say the downsides far outweigh the benefits. The next article from the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled, Some Medications Can Make Arizona Heat Extra Dangerous. This article was written by Fatima Gabir of the Cronkite News. Simply walking from your front door to your mailbox in the summer heat can be dangerous, especially for older adults taking certain medications. As our body ages, our body's ability to cope with the heat and respond to the heat changes, said Mona Arora, assistant research professor at the University of Arizona College of Public Health. Things can deteriorate quickly when medications from this Centers for Disease Control list are added to the mix of heat and age. The outcomes of this combination varies. Some stimulants, antihistamines, psychiatric or cardiovascular drugs can confuse the body's ability to regulate temperature, while antifungals and antibiotics can increase the risks of sunburn. Heat-related deaths are becoming more common, especially in Arizona where the temperatures have grown significantly hotter each year. Extreme heat is the leading cause of weather-related deaths, followed by rip currents and tornadoes. Older adults with common chronic conditions, many of whom take medications that increase their vulnerability to heat, face growing risk, especially as exposure becomes harder to avoid. More than 66% of heat-related illness hospitalizations were in combination with cardiovascular disease, according to the Arizona Department of Health Services. However, the relationship between heat and medication is complicated. It's not that one-to-one relationship in which I'm on this medication, so I'm at increased risk, Aurora said. It's not just the medication itself, but it's also these other driving factors like not being able to recognize that, hey, I'm thirsty. Some medications disrupt thermoregulation and fluid balance, heightening the risks associated with hot weather. Diuretics, which cause people to urinate more frequently, can reduce thirst, whereas antidepressants and antipsychotics might hinder sweating. So if you're already in a pre-dehydrated state and you go out and are more susceptible to heat, that's going to cause you to be less resilient, said Brian Drummond, an emergency physician and clinical professor at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson and a member of the Heat and Medications Task Force, a statewide effort to raise awareness on how medications affect heat risks. Drummond also noted that medications can interfere with cognition and mental status, affecting the ability to make good decisions. If you know you're in the heat, get out of the heat. If you have to make that cognitive decision, I'm going to leave this hot area and find a cooler place to be. Every year, Drummond sees patients who are sick from the heat, and the reasons vary. Some patients donate plasma, for example, to generate income and then walk to the bus stop where they end up vomiting and fainting, Drummond said. A study published in the National Library of Medicine investigated the connection between heat waves, common medications for chronic conditions, and the risk of heat-related hospitalization for people on Medicare. The authors recommended changes to prescription guidelines, drug labeling policies, and how the public is informed during heat waves. Aurora, who is also part of the Arizona Task Force to raise awareness on how medications mix with heat risk, suggested patients be proactive. We encourage people to seek out their local pharmacist, to seek out their doctor. Talk to them, especially now as we get into the heat season, because they can look at your own individual history and be able to give you more specific information on if you have medications that cause dehydration, how much more water is that you really should be drinking, Aurora said. Pima County in southern Arizona is developing a year-long analysis of heat-related deaths and prescription histories, according to Mark Person, public health program manager for the Pima County Health Department. The analysis examines medical records sent to the medical examiner's office from hospitals and primary care doctors. Although the findings have not been published yet due to data requirements, we already know that drugs increase the risk of hypothermia when the body's temperature rises, but we do not know how often people who die of hypothermia are also taking these medications, Person wrote in an email to Cronkite News. If we can answer this question, it will help us expand upon traditional heat safety messaging. The task force created an information sheet for healthcare providers with questions for patients to help mitigate that heat risks and recommendations to assess medications or dosages. We want people to be aware of what the risks are so that they can plan accordingly. If they're prescribed medications, the best course of action is to continue taking it, but to also have these discussions with their providers and think through ways they can protect themselves in the heat, said Jennifer Botsworth, Bureau Chief for Environmental Health at the Arizona Department of Health Services and Arizona Task Force member. Now it's time to flip the pages to the Nation, the World section of the Arizona Daily Star to check out several important news articles there. The first article is titled, Second Child Dies of Disease. This article was written by Debbie Chastry and Amanda Seitz of the Associated Press. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. visited the epicenter of Texas' still-growing measles outbreak on Sunday. The same day, a funeral was held for a second young child who was not vaccinated and died from a measles-related illness. Kennedy said in a social media post that he was working to control the outbreak and went to Gaines County to comfort the families who have buried two young children. He was seen late Sunday afternoon outside of a Mennonite church where the funeral services were held, but he did not attend the nearby news conference held by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about the outbreak. Seminole is the epicenter of the outbreak, which started in late January and continues to swell, with nearly 500 cases in Texas alone, plus cases from the outbreak believed to have spread to New Mexico, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Mexico. The second young child died Thursday from what the child's doctor described as measles pulmonary failure and did not have underlying health conditions. The Texas State Department of State Health Services said Sunday in a news release. Aaron Davis, a spokesperson for UMC Health System in Lubbock, said that the child was receiving treatment for complications of measles while hospitalized. This is the third known measles-related death tied to this outbreak. One was another elementary school-aged child in Texas, and the other was an adult in New Mexico. Neither was vaccinated. It's Kennedy's first visit to the area as health secretary, where he said he met with families of both the 6 and 8-year-old children who died. He said he developed bonds with the Mennonite community in West Texas, in which the virus is mostly spread. Kennedy, an anti-vaccine advocate before ascending to the role of nation's top health secretary earlier this year, has resisted urging widespread vaccination as the measles outbreak has worsened under his watch. On Sunday, however, he said in a lengthy statement posted on X that it was the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles. The measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine has been used safely for more than 60 years and is 97% effective against measles after two doses. Dr. Manisha Patel, CDC incident manager, said in a Sunday news conference that the MMR vaccine is the best way to protect against measles. He also told parents in Gaines County that it was important not to delay care for the child who is sick with measles. Call your doctor and make sure you're talking to a healthcare professional who can guide you in those next steps, Patel said. CDC teams arrived in early March, Patel said, but Kennedy's social media post noted that CDC employees have been redeployed and the nation's public health agency never relayed it pulled back. The next article is titled, Israeli Strikes on Gaza Kill 32. This article was written by the Associated Press, Dateline, Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. Israeli strikes in the Gaza Strip killed at least 32 people, including over a dozen women and children, local health officials said Sunday, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu headed to the United States to meet with President Donald Trump about the war. Israel last month ended its ceasefire with Hamas and has seized territory to pressure the militant group to accept a new deal for a truce and release of remaining hostages. It has blocked the import of fuel, food, and other supplies for over a month to the coastal territory heavily reliant on outside assistance. Israeli military late Sunday ordered Palestinians to evacuate several neighborhoods in central Gaza Deir al-Balah shortly after about 10 projectiles were fired from Gaza, the largest barrage from the territory since Israel resumed the war. The military said about 5 were intercepted. Hamas military arm claimed responsibility. Police said a rocket fell in Ashkelon City and fragments fell in several other areas. The Magen David Odom Emergency Service said one man was lightly injured. The military later said it struck a rocket launcher in Gaza. Israeli strikes overnight into Sunday hit a tent in a house in the southern city of Khan Yunis, killing 5 men, 5 women, and 5 children, according to Nasser Hospital, which received the bodies. The body of a toddler took up one end of the emergency stretcher. A female journalist was among the dead. "My daughter was innocent. She had no involvement. She loved journalism and adored it," said her mother, Amal Kaskin. Trump wants to end the Gaza issue. "He's in a hurry, and it is clear from this morning," said Mohammed Abdelhadi, cousin of a woman killed. Israeli shelling killed at least 4 people in the Jabalaya refugee camp in northern Gaza, according to Gaza's health ministry. The bodies of 7 people, including a child and 3 women, arrived at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, according to an Associated Press journalist there. And a strike in Gaza City hit people waiting outside a bakery and killed at least 6, including 3 children, according to the civil defense, which operates under the Hamas-run government. Dozens of Palestinians took to the streets in Jabalaya for a new round of anti-war protests. Footage circulating on social media showed people marching and chanting against Hamas. Such protests, while rare, have occurred in recent weeks. There is also anger inside Israel over the war's resumption and its effects on remaining hostages in Gaza. Families of hostages, along with some of those recently freed from Gaza and their supporters, on Saturday urged Trump to help ensure the fighting ends. Netanyahu will meet with Trump on Monday for the second time since Trump began his latest term in January. The prime minister said they would discuss the war and the new 17% tariff imposed on Israel, part of a sweeping global decision by the new U.S. administration. The title of the next article is Ukraine-U.S. Plan Meeting on New Draft Mineral Deal. This article came from the Associated Press, Dateline Kyiv, Ukraine. Ukraine will send a team to Washington next week to begin negotiations on a new draft of a deal that would give the U.S. access to Ukraine's valuable mineral resources, economy Minister Yulia Sekhradenko told the Associated Press. The new draft agreement from the U.S. shows that the intention to create a fund or jointly invest remains, Sekhradenko said Saturday during a trip to northern Ukraine. The delegation from Kiev will include representatives from the ministries of Economy, Foreign Affairs, Justice, and Finance. The long-running negotiations over a mineral deal have already strained relations between Kiev and Washington. The two sides had been preparing in February to sign a framework agreement, but the plan was derailed following a contentious meeting in the Oval Office between U.S. President Donald Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. After some Ukrainian lawmakers leaked a new draft, critics slammed it as a little more than an attempt to strip Kiev of control over its own natural resources and infrastructure. According to the leaked document, the new draft includes not only rare earth minerals, but also gas and oil. Ukraine holds significant deposits of more than 20 minerals deemed strategically critical by the U.S., including titanium, which is used to make aircraft wings, lithium, key to several battery technologies, and uranium used in nuclear power. Now we'll head over to the business section of the Arizona Daily Star for an interesting article there. Titled is Indonesia's Cocoa Farmers Fight Climate Change. This article was written by Victoria Milko and Dita Alangkara of the Associated Press, Dateline, Tanjung Rejo, Indonesia. The loud whir of a chainsaw resonates through the forest as a small group of farmers gathers around a tree filled with red seed pods. With one slow stroke, a severed knobby branch hits the ground. Now it will help the tree grow new fruit, farmer Terry Santoso said with a smile. Thousands of cocoa farmers like Santoso across Indonesia work with businesses and other organizations to protect their crops from the bitter impacts of climate change and underinvestment that pushed cocoa prices to record levels. Cocoa trees are high maintenance. Grown only near the equator, they require a precise combination of steady temperatures, humidity, and sunlight. It takes 5 years for a tree to start producing the seeds that are processed into cocoa used to make chocolate and other delectable foods. Climate change increases the risk for farmers. Hotter weather hurts yields, and longer rainy seasons trigger the spread of fungus and deadly pests. Increasingly unpredictable weather patterns make it harder for farmers to deal with those challenges. So farmers are switching to other crops, reducing cocoa supplies and pushing prices higher. In 2024, prices nearly tripled, reaching about $12,000 per ton, driving up chocolate costs and leading some chocolate makers to try growing cocoa in laboratories. Indonesia is the third largest producer of cocoa in the world, behind Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. Farmers in Indonesia are joining with businesses and non-governmental organizations to develop better growing practices and improve their livelihood. Sitting in the shade of his forest farm in South Sumatra, 3 miles from a national park where Sumatran's tigers and rhinos roam, farmer Santoso works with Indonesian chocolate maker Krakakao. After he began working with the company in 2016, Santoso started using practices that helped his cocoa trees flourish, regularly pruning and grafting new branches onto older trees to promote growth and prevent the spread of disease. He is using organic fertilizer and adopted agroforestry techniques, integrating other crops and trees such as bananas, dragon fruit, coffee, and pepper into his farm to foster a healthy ecosystem and invest in other income sources. It wasn't very successful before we met Krakakoa, and Santoso said, but then we received training, things are much better. Krakakoa has trained more than 1,000 cocoa farmers in Indonesia, according to its founder and CEO Sabrina Mustopo. The company also provides financial support. Santoso and other farmers in Sumatra said the partnership helped them to form a cooperative that provides low-interest loans to farmers with interest paid back into the cooperative rather than to banks outside the community. Cocoa farmers who need bigger loans from government-owned banks also benefit from partnering with businesses, as the guarantee buyer agreements that provide collateral needed to get loans approved, said Armin Hari, a communications manager at the Cocoa Sustainability Partnership, a forum for public-private collaboration for cocoa development in Indonesia. Dozens of other businesses, the government, and the non-governmental organizations that cooperatives are working with cocoa farmers to help them better cope with climate change, benefiting thousands, Hari said. He pointed to a collaboration between Indonesia's National Research and Innovation Agency and the local division of international chocolate maker Mars, which released a new variant of cocoa that produces more pods per tree. Challenges still remain, said Rajendra Ariel, the FAO's country director for Indonesia. Fewer people see cocoa farming as a lucrative business and instead are planting other crops, such as trees for palm oil. Also, many small-scale farmers still cannot get loans, he said. However, Ariel said he hopes that continued collaboration between farmers and others will help. If we can look at the major issues these farmers are facing, I think the sector could be again very attractive to farmers, he said. Despite the challenges in Indonesia, I see that there are opportunities. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, April 7th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.